You start over here in 1950 with the first generation of nuclear reactors, and they had almost no safety features. We pretty much discovered that we could use nuclear reactors to create electricity, and we kind of just started building. So with each generation of nuclear reactors, we actually increase in the safety features and the efficiency of these reactors. So the next generation of nuclear reactors are these Generation 4 nuclear reactors. They're going to come out in the year 2030. And they're going to reach really high efficiency because we're going to reach higher temperatures and pressures than we ever have before. Now, there's many subsets of these next generation of nuclear reactors. I am working in the subset of the supercritical water reactors. Now, these have an advantage over some of the other reactors because they have a very simple design. As you see, it's a one-loop system. They use water for one, and they can actually reach an efficiency from the latest studies that have been done up to 50%, which is a greatly increased over the efficiency that we have in our nuclear reactors today because they only reach 33 to 35% efficiency. Okay, so I'm going to kind of just walk you through how it works a little bit. So we start down here at the pump, and the water is at a specific pressure, and it gets pumped into the reactor and through the reactor core where it picks up energy and is heated into the supercritical water state. The supercritical water is then pumped into the turbine, and the thermal energy is then converted into mechanical energy, and ta-da, we get electrical power. This water then goes into the condenser, and any excess heat is taken off, and then it will start the cycle again. Okay, so now I've introduced, you know, supercritical water, but as most of us are physicists here, you probably are doing the same thing that I did and going, what the heck is supercritical water? Well, every substance has a critical point. Above this critical point, there is no phase transition, which means that to go from a liquid to a vapor, it doesn't need to boil anymore. Now, for water, the specific critical point is 374 degrees Celsius and 218 atmospheres. This means that in the supercritical state, you get liquid and gas properties at the same time, and these properties are actually tunable. So if you're over here in this range, you end up getting something that acts more like a liquid, whereas if you're in this range, you end up something that acts more like a vapor. Now, actually, something that's super cool about supercritical water specifically is that it acts like an organic solvent. You can actually end up sustaining a flame in supercritical water, which is completely counterintuitive. Okay, so the reactor chemistry that I'm studying is this reaction right here, hydrogen plus water. This is really important for the safety studies of these next generation of nuclear reactors. Now, as you can see by my little schematic here, we've got two reaction pathways. Both are excessively important because they directly or indirectly lead to hydrogen, molecular hydrogen. Now, you're saying, you know, why is this important? Well, in the generations of reactors that we have today, we actually add molecular hydrogen into the coolant because it reduces corrosion at small concentrations. But if we're at very high temperatures, the question is, will we produce too much hydrogen in these reactions, and will we actually end up exploding our nuclear reactor? So what we have done in our group is we've taken the temperature and pressure dependence of these reactions. And how we do that is with μSR, which stands for muon spin resonance, relaxation, rotation. I mean, you can use any one of those works. We have to use μSR because it's the only technique that we can use under these extreme conditions. I mean, we're reaching temperatures, you know, up to 450 degrees Celsius and 300 bar. So it's the only possible way that we can study these reactions. Not only that, but it's clean. The only way to study our specific reaction of hydrogen plus water is to use this μSR technique, because other techniques you have to add things like scavengers in, which enable you to detect how the reaction is proceeding. But with μSR, we just use muons. Okay, so here's where the antimatter part comes in. I've been saying, you know, we've been using muons, but technically we're using the antimuon, but, I mean, physicists and chemists alike are lazy, so we just call it μSR. The antimuon still has the average lifetime of 2.2 microseconds. And so what muonium is, which is what we actually study, is your muon enters your sample, and then it steals an electron from the surrounding environment. So you end up with a positive charge and a negative charge that orbits it. So you're saying, so really the reaction I have studied is this one right here. But if you look, this is the reaction that we want to study. And I say right here that we have 99.5% the reduced mass of hydrogen. Now what that means is that their properties are almost exactly the same, which means if we study this reaction, we can actually extrapolate the results that we get to find out, well, how hydrogen would react under these conditions. Okay, so transverse field mu SR starts like any mu SR with an injection line at a place like Triumph. We start with hydrogen molecules, which are ripped up a proton, and then they enter the cyclotron. They accelerate in the cyclotron, and then they hit a metal foil, and that strips the electrons from it and leaves just the proton. This proton then enters the beamline and is immediately collided with a carbon atom. Now, this carbon atom creates a pion, and as Chloe actually just explained, this pion will decay into a few particles, but what we're interested in is the muons. So the muons then travel down the beamline and into your experimental area. So a closer look at transverse field mu SR specifically, we've got our 100% spin polarized muons coming through and entering your sample. When they do that, they pass through a muon detector, which starts an electronic clock. Now, because our field is transverse, which means it's perpendicular to the spin of the muon, the spin actually processes around this magnetic field. Now, eventually in 2.2 microseconds, when it ends up decaying, you get a positron, which is another antimatter particle. Now, you actually have positron detectors set up all around the outside of your sample, and so when this positron hits one of these detectors, it'll stop this electronic clock. Now, after, you know, millions of these counts and quite a few hours, you get plots, histograms, that look like this. Oh, this is dying. Okay. So this one right here is the raw data. So you see this very steep decay, and that's the decay of the muon itself. So once we've accounted for that, you get plots that look like this. And this is very clear right here, this precession here, this frequency. Now this frequency decays at a certain rate, at a certain lambda. Now, this lambda is actually proportional to the rate constant of the reaction, how fast the reaction proceeds forward. Now, it goes by this equation right here, and this is the important part. This is the experimental lambda that we're looking for. And you see this extra term right here. Well, this is the diamagnetic. Okay, it's a much larger frequency, and because of that, it doesn't actually, or a much longer wavelength. So because of that, it doesn't actually have any... It is, like, it's so small that we can neglect this part of the equation. Okay, so here are my temperature dependence data. Now, as you can see, I have made a fit right here, and just to show you like the error bars of this fit, I've got kind of a lower and an upper error, just to give you an idea. Okay, so from these we can find the activation enthalpies, activation energies, and activation entropies. Okay, and then now here's my pressure dependence data. Right here, it's not very interesting because we pretty much have no pressure dependence data until we start getting to 425 degrees Celsius. Now, from the slopes of these lines, we can actually find the activation volumes. So here are some of my numbers here. Now, from this 18, we know that this reaction at these temperatures is actually going through this reaction pathway as opposed to this one. Now, how do I know that? We know from other studies that have been done that this reaction pathway actually has a 96 kilojoules per mole, and this is only 18. So clearly, it has to be going through this reaction pathway. And this is further evidenced by the other numbers that we have here. The activation entropy, which is a measure of disorder, you get a negative, which means that the disorder of the reactants is actually greater than the disorder of the products, which, if you know anything about entropy, isn't really usually favorable, as well as the activation volumes. You start off with the negative activation volumes, which means there's more volume in the reactants than in the products, and then you transition into almost no activation volume, like they seem to be canceling each other out as they switch from this negative activation volume to a positive activation volume, and then at 425 degrees Celsius, you start to see the reaction start to favor this part. Okay, so some conclusions in future research. So we seem to have lots of hydrogen produced with these reactions, and it's only going to increase as we increase our temperature. So that means that we're likely going to have water, the water coolant as pure instead of adding hydrogen into it. So some of the future research that we're going to do in our group is we're going to go to some higher temperatures, up to 650 degrees Celsius. We're going to go to lower pressures just to make sure that we still have no pressure dependence even there. And we're going to start studying some of these other reactive species. Okay, so I'd just like to thank our sponsors for giving us, you know, money to do these studies. ACENET for their computational power. Of course, my professor and the group that I work for, and of course, the Women in Physics organizers for allowing me to talk today. Thank you.
This paper is open now for questions.
So I'm wondering, can you go back to the graph right before your experimental results?
The graph? Yeah, sure. Which one is back? Oh, there we go. Perfect.
So that one right
this
there?
One?
Yeah, I'm just wondering if you have that point right there with such a huge error, why would you even include it in your result or in your graph?
Okay, yeah, that's a really good question. Okay, it doesn't necessarily mean it's, like, really bad. It's just that... I don't know if you've ever been to Triumph, but that's where we collected our data. What happens is you set up your experiment, and you actually have to let it run for quite a few hours to collect data. The longer that it runs, the better error you get, basically, the smaller error you get. So what happened with this point is that we ran out of time, so we had to kind of cut it short, but... It's still very good because what we have to do is we actually have to pure the water. Like, it took us, you know, 4 or 5 days to get water pure enough that we could actually start doing reactions on. So it does seem to be a fairly large error, but in reality, it's a little bit tricky because our water was very pure, so we know that the error is actually slightly smaller than actually shown from our numerical.